Today we are going to look at Mark chapter 8, verses 22 through 30. The title is Beginning to See. So, let's see, Mark chapter 8, verses 22 through chapter 9, verse 1, forms a kind of hinge between what has come before in this gospel account and what will follow. This section, and in particular verses 27 through 33 of chapter 8, serves as the center of the entire Markan gospel account. In these verses, the reader is given a dense and packed summary of what Mark finds most important about the gospel and what it is that he wants to communicate to his audience. So we're going to examine this section in two parts, and maybe three, depending on how much ranting goes on. So that we have sufficient time to explore what Mark has to say. Now, leading up to these verses, we've seen Jesus defying the cultural and religious traditions regarding the Messiah, of Jesus breaking down boundaries and traditions, and of the people wondering who Jesus is. We have seen how individuals and groups in power and those who exercise authority, represented in Mark's gospel by Herod and the Pharisees, of trying to force Jesus to fit into their schemes. And right immediately preceding, we've heard Jesus warn his disciples about the leaven of Herod and of the Pharisees. And we have heard Jesus call the disciples that they are blind and deaf. And so it's in this context that the next verses are to be read and interpreted. So we will first look at verses 22 through 26, which is a miracle story, a healing story, but one which can be titled a bumbled healing. And it reads, "And they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought to him a blind man and begged him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village, and when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, 'Do you see anything?' And he looked up and said, 'I see people, but they look like trees walking.' Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And he sent him to his home, saying, 'Do not even enter the village.'" Jesus had tried to get to Bethsaida earlier in this gospel account, back in chapter 6, verse 45, right after the feeding of the 5,000. But a storm prevented him from succeeding the first time. He now finally makes it. Bethsaida is important as a port city that will take Jesus on the way to Caesarea Philippi, a seat of imperial Roman power in this region. Rhetorically, it's important to recognize that this is the middle of three key healing the deaf and blind stories that are found in Mark. The first is found in chapter 7, verses 31 through 37, and the third will be encountered in chapter 10, verses 46 through 52. In both the first and the last accounts, the healing takes place immediately. It's only in this middle one where Jesus seems to have some difficulties in healing this blind man. And in fact, this two-stage healing, this difficulty is in performing a miracle, is found only here across all of the gospel accounts. Let's see.
Is he on the Jewish or the Gentile side?
It's kind of on the Gentile side. It's on the eastern shore. It's on the northeastern tip of Lake Gennesaret, or the Sea of Galilee.
So, kind of on the Gentile side. Are there both? Is it a mix?
Well, it's on the eastern side. There's the Jordan River comes down. And you've got the eastern side and the western side. there are two cities on either side. Bethsaida is the eastern one. Capernaum, I believe, is the one on the other side.
So all the other Gospels, is that the one where he spits in the mud and puts it on his eyes?
We saw that in chapter 7, verses 31 through 37 as well.
Okay, so that was earlier in this Gospel.
And that pertained to the fact that he was in a Gentile environment where he needed to recreate and kind of assimilate some of their cultural standards for religion. So they needed ritual or
custom.
Spit was considered to have some kind of magical properties in healing.
Is that why we kiss?
Yeah.
Well, it was like
sure.
You had to give some essence of the person in order to have it. There's so many rituals that they mm-hmm. needed to show something, or the people mm-hmm. wouldn't even understand.
Uh-huh. And these healings of the blind also allude to Isaiah 35, verses 5 and 6, which was considered, and which still is considered, a messianic passage. Before we go on, let's see, here is a paragraph from a commentary. Jesus' display of extraordinary power astonished his countrymen and provoked the question of the source of his authority and wisdom, but his true dignity remained unrecognized. His association with sinners and disregard for accepted conventions of piety so scandalized the guardians of an inherited tradition that they could think only in terms of the demonic. The recognition of the demons communicated nothing to the bystanders but frenzied opposition to Jesus. The disciples raised the question of Jesus' identity but found no categories by which they could understand him and failed to penetrate the veiledness which characterized his words and works. By weaving these several stands of the tradition together in the first half of the Gospel, Mark creates a climate of tension which can be resolved only by the recognition of Jesus' dignity. The pointed question of chapter 8:21, "Do you not understand?" cries for the answer provided in chapter 8, verse 29, "You are the Messiah." And this healing miracle story happens in between those two statements, "Do you not understand?" and "You are the Messiah." So what are some rhetorical reasons Mark draws out the journey to Bethsaida? In other words, why do you think Mark mentions the fact that Jesus tried to get to Bethsaida back in chapter 6, and now he finally makes it in chapter 8?
Did he need to go get schooled by the lady there before he came back there? Because, I mean, if you're saying "you are," it's a statement of Christ needing to understand something, not somebody else.
Possibly.
So, because if you think about him having to redo the miracle, in a sense, maybe Christ was forgetting how he was supposed to show him, not show himself, but that at some point there had to be a mysticism to him, because he couldn't just follow the way they did things.
It was Mark's intent to show that Jesus had, from the very beginning, wanted to get to Bethsaida, but a storm representing demonic forces had prevented him from reaching Bethsaida the first time.
So the Bethsaida people, the demoniacs, were not Jews.
The demoniacs were elsewhere. They weren't in Bethsaida.
Okay.
Who was in Bethsaida?
Jesus hadn't been here yet. He had been trying to get here.
This blind person that he provided sight to, was he a Gentile or Jew?
He would probably be. The probability is that he was Gentile.
Before this, had Jesus healed Gentiles yet?
Yes.
Who?
The girl of the woman who successfully answered the riddle of the dog.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Among several others.
Uh-huh. But most pointedly, when he...
Something is important about Bethsaida.
Uh-huh.
Well, what Ray's leading to is Jesus is learning. Jesus is being led by his learning program that, hey, maybe these blessings are not just for the Jews. Maybe these blessings are for the Gentiles, too. Uh-huh. Is he teaching or is he learning, I guess? That's the question.
That's the question.
But this may not have anything to do with that right now.
It probably doesn't.
Yeah.
The thing,
he's not saying, yeah. It's just,
the thing that's happening is that during Jesus' first boat crossing of the sea, of the lake, to try to get to Bethsaida, he was prevented by a storm. And the disciples had exclaimed, had demonstrated unbelief and had exclaimed in a question form, "Who is this?" Referring to Jesus, who can still
the waters. So we're back to who he is now. We're not worried about Jesus learning anything. This is again, this is the disciples.
So it was Mark's first indictment of the disciples' blindness.
Right.
Now we finally get back to Bethsaida, where the blind is healed.
Is he healing their blindness?
And so
we have to look beyond the literal miracle story to see what it represents.
I mean, he's healing their metaphorical blindness. Is that what he's saying? They're finally going to understand what's going on.
Yeah, so this is what one of the commentary reads. Now the community of blind men, speaking of the disciples, finally arrives in Bethsaida, a place where it turns out blindness is healed.
So we haven't heard the rest of the story yet, then, is what's going on.
So what we want to do is we want to compare and contrast the first healing of a man that is deaf and dumb in chapter 7, verses 31 through 37, with this story involving a blind man.
Uh-huh.
So to do that, we need to go back to chapter 7. Mark chapter 7, verse 31. Okay, I use the same translation here. Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hands on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears, and after spitting, touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, "Ephphatha," that is, "be opened." And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, "He has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." Mm-hmm. And we'll read the current passage in 8 again. And they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought to him a blind man and begged him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village. And when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" And he looked up and said, "I see people, but they look like trees walking." Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And he sent him to his home, saying, "Do not even enter the village."
Mm-hmm. Both of those are in Gentile places, and both times he charged people to not know what happened.
Yeah, so let's start with the beginning. Who seeks the healing?
Someone else.
Yeah.
Someone who can.
But I thought you meant like who, as far as the apostles or the townspeople themselves.
As in someone brings him.
Well, they don't specify sometimes, you know. It's like like it could be the apostles bringing him and saying, "Here, try this guy," or it could be
sometimes the person the comes to him themselves.
No, it's generally the townspeople.
It is the town.
Here,
okay.
Here you
family that really.
You know, rather than the person who needs help, like his friends, his neighbors.
Okay. Said the Oriental custom is, you always serve tea to your friend, and your friend serves tea to you. You never fill your own teacup. You always fill your friend's teacup. I don't know if that's true or not, but that looks at it.
That is probably true, but it's not relevant to our discussion here.
Well, what I'm saying here, people aren't seeking their own. It's the community seeking their...
Right.
In these two instances, but there are other instances, so you can't make that generalization.
Like the lady touching his hand.
But these ones
must have stuck out. So what happens?
It's someone else bringing a person.
So he did a two-step healing. Was that for the benefit?
Now, the blind or the deaf, they may not actually want to be healed.
What do they know? I don't know if they're born that way.
One that was in chapter 7, that person was born deaf.
Uh-huh.
This man will, because of the fact that he recognizes that men
look like trees.
Walk around, it's an indication that he was probably not blind from birth.
That's a good point. Well, and they look like trees.
Yeah.
How does he know what trees look like? Look like.
I never thought about that.
But in the ancient world,
blind from birth,
having a physical impairment meant you did not have to work.
Ah.
Well, they didn't. There's a lot of physical impairments.
You may or may not have made good living sitting by the side of the road begging.
But you had an occupation.
But you had meaning and purpose in life. Or at least you had some function.
You have a disability taken from you and you have no skills.
Uh-huh.
Right. And so
you have to make it on your own.
We don't know for sure whether these people wanted to be healed.
Uh-huh. Well, I see what you're saying.
So, what other significance is there in the fact that the people themselves did not want to be healed, but the people around them brought these people with physical impairments to Jesus?
They're trying to get him to do something.
Maybe, they just wanted to see more miracles.
Mm-hmm. Kind of, that was cool, do it again. Here's one.
Another is that these stories mention no faith on the part of the one who comes, who has the disabilities.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know, but it seems like to me there's a broad difference between what Jesus meant when he walked through that community in his day, and what Mark was writing in this book a couple, 20, 30, 40 years later.
Yeah.
Mark had an intent, had a reason to write what he wrote, but that may or may not be in what was Jesus' intent walking through that town.
It sounds a little bit to me like a caution to the church itself to remember that the faith of the people that you are trying to help has to be coinciding with the help that you're trying to get. So, when we charge into the known world to bring this good news, we need to be bringing it to people that are actually wanting to listen to it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we are simply trying to create an environment to spellbind these people into believing what we want them to believe.
You have to create.
So if you go into the forest and light the lighter in front of the pygmy, then of course they're going to listen to you because you suddenly have something that they have never seen before. But it's without faith and understanding that they are even taking the help that you're giving. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you're gone and your fire no longer impresses them, then there's nothing, there's no substance behind the gift that you've given. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I'm hearing.
So should we even ask what Jesus' purpose
was?
What's
the point then?
Yeah, I may be totally wrong. That's what I heard.
From what we have been seeing in Mark's gospel, Jesus is often very reluctant to perform miracles.
So why did they happen?
It sounds like almost through sheer force of the overwhelming populace that was coming to greet him in most instances.
It is because of Jesus' compassion. When he encounters someone who is hurting and who is suffering, his compassion cannot let it go.
So, Jesus didn't have alternative motives. Mark was trying to explain how the disciples were blind and their eyes were open. But in the time that Jesus was there, he was his compassion was being lived out. And that's all there was to it. He was just, his compassion was being lived out.
But at the same time, you make this point about people potentially not wanting to be healed. So could Jesus' compassion
have been misplaced?
Not necessarily misplaced, but...
We'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to that, I think. Where does Jesus perform the healing? This gets to part of the question.
In private.
Not all of them, though.
Not all of them.
The two Gentile ones were in private.
In other words, he gives the person the opportunity to say, no, don't do it. In private.
And so, you know, why is it in private versus public?
Because the public would never let the person say no.
Here's what one commentary notes. If it is proper to speak of a tendency in Mark, the sphere of miracle is public rather than secret. The three exceptions to this general observation derive apparently from a set of circumstances inherent in the situation itself. This is certainly true in chapter 5, where Jesus excludes the scornful, unbelieving group of professional mourners from the revelation of his life-giving power. In chapter 7, the removal of the man from the crowd was an important action in establishing communication with an individual who had learned to be passive in society. This may provide the key to chapter 8, verse 23 as well. When Jesus took the blind man's hand and led him outside the city, he established a personal relationship to him that was an important element in the man's confidence that his cure could be expected from Jesus. Beyond this, the restoring of sight to a blind person among the mixed population of Bethsaida would have led to the type of false veneration that Jesus constantly avoided. And another commentary notes, with this in mind, it is possible to see that for Mark, the removal of the two men from the village crowds, as in chapter 7 and chapter 8, the deaf and the blind. The removal of the two men from their village crowds, in some sense, signified the separation from one's past that Jesus' message demanded. And we talked about, as part of this healing process in both 7 and 8, and Jesus spits, because one of the reasons may be that spit was thought to have some kind of curative power. Now, what is the result of the healing touch? First on the deaf man of chapter 7. Deaf and dumb. They're related. If you can't hear, you can't really talk.
Right. He's healed immediately.
In chapter 8, the man's eye is touched with spittle. And what happens?
Doesn't work.
Requires a second touch. And then, what does Jesus command at the end?
Don't go in the village.
And in chapter 8, don't even go into the village.
It's absurd. What's he supposed to do?
Hide!
Go home.
In chapter 7, it was directed to everyone there present. You know, don't speak of this.
Right.
And so some translations have added that don't speak of this in chapter 8 as well. But it's not considered to be authentic.
Don't go into the village.
For how long?
That's what I was wondering.
Did Jesus leave?
No, is that forever? Was he supposed to leave and find a new home?
No. So is that meant to be a literal prohibition? Is that something Jesus said? Is that something Mark puts into Jesus' mouth? What is the
Is he talking
meaning?
About the man leaving his occupation of begging? So it seems like he would need to do something in the village. Something else.
And we are going to get to the most likely answer to that question.
Later.
Okay,
but just because I can't stand it. So, is it just more because of, like, when somebody in a church in a small group of people or somebody in a small town seeks help, it's often hard for them to do that because of their past representation and the opinions of the individuals around them, making it so that that healing process is longer because of the welling of, like, oh, well, I remember when you did that, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So for him to be healed, he couldn't be part of the
old community, like an alcoholic leaving, not associating with his friends, not going to...
Well, not just not associating with his friends, but not being in an environment where even people that don't care, per se, that they've healed, have the just audacity or in just not even naive thought to say to them, well, I remember when you were drunk. Being harsh and improper to somebody trying to learn how to be better.
Or crowding around him, wanting to look at him, saying, let me see.
Right, or, you know, you quit drinking 10 years ago. Wow, that's amazing. You know, so that's what I'm wondering is maybe in order, because Christ's lesson sometimes is that we need to leave our past behind us. We need to leave the things that we don't fit in very well properly. You know, I mean, even in a church environment with your friends and your family can often sometimes be triggering enough for a person that's trying to get out of something like that, that they need to be completely removed from their life before that so that they can continue a better path. I'm going to stop. Sorry.
It's a good point. That may have played part in the historical situation, but that's not Mark's main point.
Okay.
Mark's main point. I'm curious what Mark's
main
point.
Me too. I'm sorry I had to talk.
At this point, someone can stir the kale into my lentil stew.
I will turn on mine.
This is our cue.
So Jesus seems to have only partially succeeded after the initial attempt to heal. What do you make of it? What is Jesus' point? What is Mark's point? Is Jesus unable to heal? What's going on here?
Or is he trying to express something else that more is needed than...
Okay. What more is needed?
The relationship.
Just one way, keep me quiet.
So he stops and touches the man again, and then it works.
So, someone might say that, well, it's because the man didn't have enough faith. What is that?
But why is it the man's problem?
Very
good
point.
It doesn't seem dependent on the man's faith at all.
One thing that's been going on in my head is we got a tent meeting downtown, and we got this preacher, and he calls someone up to heal them. If you heal them before the audience, you got a tremendous
interest factor, what do you want to call it. Mm-hmm. But if you say, hey, just go in the back, I'll do it in private, and then when we're done, mm-hmm. you go home, and you don't show your face for 3 days, the glitzy factor mm-hmm. is gone. There's nothing uh-huh. there.
I think we're past just that point real. Right now, though. We're on what I was asking about earlier, is that, so now we're back to, is Christ learning again or not? Like, is this his time to have...
Why is Jesus unable to heal on the first try? Or heal completely on the first try?
That's what I was asking. Is it because he was using too much of the mumbo jumbo and not remembering who he was supposed to be?
Or maybe it's Mark's rhetorical intent.
Okay.
To denigrate the mumbo jumbo?
It's a possibility.
Maybe the man thought spit was magic and it didn't work, so he just laid his hands on it and then he was healed.
Yeah, maybe. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Certainly some possible mumbo jumbo possible serious. Reasons.
Or is it just Mark is just leaving it open to play with it?
Why does he do that to us?
Mark certainly loves to do that sort of thing.
He does.
That's kind of what it's
in
more.
Fact, all the gospel writers love to do it.
So rhetorical.
With perhaps the exception of Matthew. Matthew seems to like answers.
Okay.
Hate the moral.
So technically when you're using rhetorical over and over again, it's just simply a round question and have fun.
Well, rhetorical question is used that way, but rhetoric is the... in its literary sense, is how a story is constructed.
Right. So he's just perpetuating a rhetoric at this point.
So here, a few paragraphs that may help to explain what might be going on, what Mark is trying to accomplish through his arrangement of stories and inclusion of particular details. Even after Jesus has performed an act of healing, the man is not healed. He sees, but he does not really see. What he sees is distorted. Nothing is said about the faith of the man or the faith of the people who bring him. This healing will take an extra effort by Jesus. The second stage of the healing simply has Jesus laying his hands on the man's eyes again. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, maybe it does have something to do with, you know, this dispelling this notion that Jesus has to perform rituals, mm-hmm. which goes along with the whole idea of rituals and traditions that Jesus has been kind of breaking and diminishing all along. Another paragraph here. Theirs is a desire, there's speaking of the people and of the disciples in regards to kind of the whole idea of a disciple of Christ. Disciple of Jesus. Theirs is a desire for power over, not power for. They have, to this point, witnessed Jesus demonstrating power over demons, over illness, over physical handicaps, over nature, over scribes and Pharisees. They have witnessed triumph after triumph. Only in Nazareth did they see that Jesus could do no mighty works because of their unbelief. That was back in chapter 6. Mm-hmm. Now, once again, Jesus' power to heal seems to come into question. Nothing is said in this case about belief or unbelief. Rather, the passage seems to be a clear commentary on the failed perceptions of the disciples. In this episode of the healing of the blind man, Mark makes Jesus appear weak in order to say something important about who Jesus is, who the disciples are, and what Jesus is doing to form them into the kind of followers and leaders they need to be. Jesus' apparent weakness is a vehicle for Mark to convey something that is at the heart of true discipleship.
I hate that when he doesn't let me be right when I first ask the question. What he's getting at is that we were talking about how Christ has to sometimes act like a Jew and sometimes act like a Gentile to get his way in the places that he's doing things. But Mark all along is like kind of, not this Mark, but the other Mark, is trying all along, and his rhetoric is that his job at that time, though, is to dispel each one of those actions in the different places that he's at. So that's what I asked, is he trying to say that? But we can't get to that answer without a little bit of roundabout, because we wouldn't understand it the third time that it's said again.
You know, the audience to whom Mark is writing knows the story already. Knows the entire story of Jesus.
And he's retelling it.
He's retelling it, emphasizing aspects about discipleship and about what it really means to be a follower of Christ.
You're having to... it's saying we have to work within the environments that we're given, but we still have to keep the faith that we are charged with.
And I think Christians, the first generation Christians after Jesus, as well as Christians today, have a tendency to want to emphasize the dramatic parts.
The powerful over, the ability to, all of those.
Well, I'm reading into this way more than it's actually said, but we were discussing before that Jesus didn't heal him in front of the masses because of the Galatia effect, so he took him around back, and he didn't heal him on the first try, but the second try, was he trying to show the man healing isn't the point? The point is, I want to be your friend.
Maybe.
Perhaps the disciples were probably with Jesus when the healing took place. So maybe it really was Jesus trying to communicate something to the disciples.
Yeah.
Let's look at the man as a person and be his friend. It's easy to heal him, but let's be his friend.
So
Well, not just his friend, though. Like, that's...
But building relationships.
Well, no. Stopping an entire culture. It's more like it. It's so much more than a personal one man. See, this is what I learned from Paul. They're never talking to you. Everybody loves to think that the Bible was written for them. Oh, wow, that's such an epiphany I just had. But I'm starting to realize none of these people are talking to an individual. So it's 10 times more profound than Christ having an individual relationship with this man. He's literally trying to recreate a culture through this man and these 12 people that are following him around.
They don't get it.
And we don't get it. We don't get it. Our culture.
But is that, I mean, am I going overboard with that thought, or is it kind of, that's what I've been hearing, because
I don't go that way.
Every time you try to listen to Paul, he starts talking about a church. And every time this happens, you think of this individual process, but if you look into the bigger, greater overall picture, especially reading so much about history lately, that the cultural lifestyle and ideology of these people was 10 times more paramount than an individual's epiphany at that time.
Yeah, I go the other direction, is that Mark and Paul may have been written on the big screen, but Jesus was living on the individual screen. And the answer I get back to that is, we can try to be on the big screen, but the truth be told, everything has changed on the individual screen.
I've just seen what cultures can do. Mindsets in large groups of people have a monumental...
And Jesus is transforming. Well, and Jesus is working with each individual.
Change comes through individuals, but at the same time, you have to address the entire culture.
He's doing both.
Which is really hard.
So this is Isaiah chapter 35. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, he will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. For waters break forth in the wilderness, and streams in the desert. The burning sand shall become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. In the haunt of jackals where they lie down, the grass shall become reeds and rushes. And a highway shall be there, and it shall be called the Way of Holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it. It shall belong to those who walk on the way. Even if there are fools, they shall not go astray. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come upon it. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. So that is Isaiah 35, considered a messianic prophetic oracle, in which is contained this phrase, that the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, for the tongue and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. Now Jesus so far has clearly been doing what is described in verses 5 and 6. But if this entire passage is read as a messianic prophecy, there are some things that Jesus is certainly not doing.
Well, there's,
and if this is part of what forms the expectations of a Messiah, how would people see Jesus?
As a failure.
An imposter.
Weak.
Mm-hmm. Especially verse 4, where the Messiah is supposed to come with vengeance.
Mm-hmm. Well, if Jesus is trying to live his prophecy, then why would he go in the back and do it in private?
He's not. Is what Mark gets at.
Generally, he doesn't perform miracles in private. It's only in these limited instances, for some reason that the situation demands, that Jesus does his miracles in private.
See, you do have to have individual aspects of all this, but what we've been reading and learning lately is that what is happening in Mark's gospel is the fundamental ideology of the culture of the people at that time had to be cracked in order for these disciples, the individuals, to take the reign of what Christ was saying away from the boxes and the lines that we've drawn and the ideas that man has created for his God to fit in, for his interest, for us to be able to abolish and let those go as a society, a culture, and an individual, to be able to hear what Christ at that time is trying to give to people. So this idea that your God's going to come down, smote everybody, take it all over and make it all better, Christ at that time, and Mark depicting it, is trying to make people understand that.
Yeah, so we're going to see that Mark's gospel is written in two halves, with this kind of in the center. The first half is Jesus deconstructing ideas and traditions about the Messiah.
So in the second half, does he reconstruct?
Second half, he reconstructs it in a way that no one
wants to listen.
No one expects or wants.
Okay.
Cool. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do it.
That's recreative.
That's cool.
We've all been having to listen to that and accept it for what it is.
We're doing good.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
And I think this reference to Isaiah 35 is important because it frames kind of the popular understanding of what the Messiah was and still is today.
It really helps, though, that we went through Revelations the way that we did prior to learning some of these things, because it makes you realize that a lot of what was being told was not necessarily literal to the idea that our God is the wave of cleansing that comes. It's more the rejoicing that it's already happened type thing. That it wasn't an actual literal event of fire and brimstone, but of a cultural epiphany and change of latitude. So that for me in that regard helps me understand these parts more, because I'm not looking for that standard in God at that time. Is it Isaiah or was it the other, who was it that was the Old Testament writer? It wasn't Isaiah that wrote the Old Testament version of Revelations. Who was that
Daniel.
One?
Daniel.
There was another one, though, wasn't there?
That we kept going back.
Ezekiel, Jeremiah.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, it was just seeing those transitions back and forth makes all of this a little easier to understand.
Yeah, there were some serious expectations about what the Messiah was supposed to be.
Kind of that we still hold on to.
A tangent, but related. Modern-day professors would probably fail Jesus and Paul in biblical studies because they would fail to, they violate all the laws, all the rules of proper biblical interpretation.
Are you saying the way the Bible is commonly interpreted today?
And
is inappropriate?
You know, kind of the way we've been doing things, it is, you know, according to the how we're supposed to interpret. You know, there are guidelines and rules and methods that we're supposed to follow so that we get the right interpretation. And Jesus and Paul violated those rules quite a bit.
Well, a lot of that was because at those times when we've read about the Corinthians, it was because they were very specifically trying to stop people from engaging in their doctrines to create their impression of God upon the individuals around them, to stop that, to stop man's power over God.
And one of the reasons that we would consider Jesus and Paul violating proper rules of exegesis or hermeneutics is that they looked at it in a Jewish way. Mm-hmm. For the Jews, the text is not the final say. It's the starting point. It's the starting point from which to draw conclusions.
That in a room full of 10 rabbis were never the same.
Right.
We're a room full of...
Well, our doctrines are so solidified in every different church that it's unbelievable that if you don't come to the outcome that they're reading to you, they're going to read it to you again and again to make sure
that you get the moral.
So let's continue here. Man, maybe we can actually finish this entire set of texts today. Who do you say that I am? Verses 27 through 30 of chapter 8. And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Christ," or Messiah. And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him.
Is that the first assertion by a disciple that he is the Messiah?
It is the first assertion, at least in this gospel. So these verses echo what Herod and those around him said about Jesus back in chapter 6. In fact, the ordering is identical. When Herod wondered about Jesus, the first response was, well, it's John the Baptist, come back to life. And then others in the court said, well, it's Elijah. And then some of the others said, well, it's one of the prophets. And then Herod replies for himself, oh, he's John the Baptist.
So is Peter or is Mark writing? Is he consciously echoing?
He is very consciously, rhetorically, paralleling chapter 6. Because he wants his audience to go back to that. But now Jesus asks the disciples directly, but who do you say that I am? And the you here is plural, meaning Jesus is asking all of them. And Peter responds as the representative voice. The other synoptic gospels record parallel accounts of this story in Matthew 16 and Luke 9. In Matthew, Jesus can be seen as commending Peter for his response. In other words, in response, Jesus says, upon this rock I will build my church.
Right.
But then, a little later, Jesus also commands, don't tell anyone. In Luke, there is no mention of this command, don't tell anyone.
Is Mark the only one that says, where he says, don't tell?
No, Matthew says.
But
there is no commendation for Peter's response.
Well, why would the gospel writers write that in there if you're not supposed to tell? Now they tell it to the whole world.
Well,
maybe it was don't tell anyone for a few days so I can get them out of here.
they're writing after the crucifixion and the resurrection.
That's true.
And Jesus is speaking it when those things haven't happened yet.
This is happening after he's been resurrected.
No, this is all leading up to.
Yeah.
They're not writing about it till after.
Mark is writing after both of those things.
In Mark's gospel, at this point, the disciples
don't know that Jesus is going to die and come back yet. Sorry.
And Jesus is saying,
it is. It's exciting because it's coming to a head. We're getting. We talked about that at the beginning of these.
And some of the don't say anything seems to be wait until after the resurrection.
Well, he's trying, I think,
and then to.
There's more to it, though, and I'm sorry, Dolores, but there's more to the wait until after the resurrection because there's been often times where Christ himself didn't know about that part yet, right? Or was unsure of, or had to have faith of that part.
Particularly in Mark's gospel, Jesus is very human. Mm-hmm. He is not necessarily this all-knowing being that's found in John's gospel, which is the last of the gospels written. In John's gospel, Jesus is very much divine. In fact, his divinity is the primary point of John's gospel. In Mark, it's the humanity of Jesus.
And this is important to me because of the cultural history that I've been reading in our recent history of like 500 years where religious belief of individuals, especially in modern Christian doctrine, have created entire cultures based on this Christian mentality. Here that we missed completely. So this to me is really exciting because there's a point here where the humanity factor of Christ being missed and the writing before the resurrection is to me starting to become pretty interesting because it's almost a lesson in Mark as to how we're supposed to give that news. Because of there's got to be a form of humility to it or something. There's got to be. It's different than anything else we've been listening to, and it's almost giving up that information a little bit about what we're supposed to do.
So, continuing now, here is the reason why this whole trip to Bethsaida and now Jesus's trip up to Caesarea Philippi is important. The geographic context for this story is significant. Jesus had just been in Bethsaida, the northeast fishing town on the Sea of Galilee that belonged to Philip's tetrarchy. Caesarea Philippi was further north in this territory and was to be distinguished from the much larger coastal city of Caesarea Maritima. Herod the Great had named this inland Caesarea in honor of Augustus. He also had a temple of white marble built and dedicated to Augustus in the city. The imperial overtones underlying the geographic location of the story are clear. Mark has Jesus identified as the Christ, the Anointed One, the Messiah, indeed a royal figure, precisely here in a city dedicated to another king, and from Mark's perspective, a lesser earthly king. The eventual irony of the charges against Jesus that he was the king of the Jews is already anticipated in chapter 8, verses 27 through 30. And let's see, a sentence here from another commentary. The area was thus dominated by strong Roman associations, and it may be theologically significant that Jesus' dignity was first recognized in a region devoted to the affirmation that Caesar is Lord.
So,
whoa.
So Caesarea is a political, is politically significant.
It was, yeah, it was definitely a highly influenced by Rome. Unlike the region of Judea or Galilee. Galilee was considered kind of a backwaters.
Mm-hmm.
Judea was controlled by the Jews.
And even the Hebrew the Hebrew part of things was. Like, Herod was when Caesar walked to become a god prior to Augustus, Herod was, like, in the back. Mm-hmm. He was, like, in the back, man. He was, like, back there, not even part of that initiation. They bought Herod. The Jewish people, the hierarchy, bought Herod for their purpose to try to control their society at that time. And gave him to Caesar so Caesar could control Judea at that time. And so Herod giving that temple to... This is really going into the political venue of what was going on Paul was writing all this. And
so you have the Sea of Galilee, Lake Gennesaret. You have the Tetrarchy of Philip kind of over here. You have Galilee over here, and then you have Judea down here. Jesus is in the northernmost part of...
He's touching very close to the the Greek part of Rome. He's on the outskirts of Macedonia at the time. This is like basically knocking on the door of where Romans that call themselves Romans wouldn't really go any further than. That's like, we don't go further.
So this is where what I meant by a segue earlier on about an hour ago.
Don't worry, I'm getting the pressure from everywhere, so it's okay.
Traditionally, Jesus has been pictured or depicted as apolitical.
Uh-huh.
Recent scholarship has been revising that view to some extent. Uh-huh. And these sets of verses that we just read, when understood in their historical context, support that revision. So, how does it inform how Christians engage our present world?
That we're still in a hostile environment that we might need to quietly tread upon because of the overwhelming, at this time right here where Christ is asking people to be quiet, and to tread lightly on the subject of his power, it's almost ridiculously political at this time that he's asking these things, because what has just happened in history, and this is real history, this isn't just the Bible's real history, but this is actual history that people can say scientifically happened at the time. This isn't just fantasy land. History at this time is a huge uproar. If this is Augustus, we've left the Punic area. We're in a solidified Romanic Empire at this time that is being that somebody's controlling this environment, and Jesus at this time is literally having to deal with Augustus, who is favored greatly by the people around him to the point where they're asking for him as a king, when the Republic of Rome is trying to denounce him quietly, but has had to embrace an emperor at this time. And for Christ to be rocking around like, yeah, I got this, would be basically putting a target on the head of every Christian at that time to be murdered ruthlessly, swiftly, and had this whole thing abolished immediately, because Augustus at that time quietly was one of the most ruthless rulers known to the world at that time. Nobody lived if he was... Nobody lived. He murdered everybody in his court before he came home.
And Jesus is in a location that symbolizes the power of the Caesar.
Recent power.
So it makes sense.
So when Jesus asks his disciples in Roman territory, who am I? Who do you say that I am?
Uh-huh.
What is he asking the disciples?
To put a target on their back.
To switch allegiances. To not necessarily switch, but to declare allegiance.
To put a target on their back. They've literally gone into the...
Yeah, and now Mark is writing this gospel to Christians in Rome.
Uh-huh.
So now... I see that this in Christians in Rome, this is a kind of a cheerleader of, not a cheerleader, but a...
it's an encouragement.
It's an encouragement. It's like somebody,
mm-hmm.
It's a campaign to Christians in Rome at this time to see the valor that these people made at that time to stand up with them because they did
for
at that time.
For them to see Peter saying in that location, making a declaration would be profound.
This would not be as fun if I hadn't read all that stuff recently.
So Peter representing all the disciples, it's not just Peter that's saying this.
Right.
It's all of the disciples around Jesus saying, you are the Christ.
Consensus.
So, is this the correct answer?
Yes.
Well, he confirms it by saying,
don't say
my church on you.
Well,
but that's
in
only
the Gospels. In some of the Gospels,
it's not in Mark.
Yes. But he sort of confirms it by saying, don't mention it.
Okay.
And at least here and now, don't mention it.
Why does Jesus command his disciples to remain silent about him, as he does with the crowd and with the demons, when the demons say,
because
you
it
are...
will shorten his work if he acts sooner than he was.
But... playing kind of the devil's advocate, no pun intended. But if Jesus' purpose was to die for our sins, when does it
over?
Just do it.
Why does it matter?
Well, he wanted... You know, Jesus, I think, was overall kind of disappointed in the disciples why they didn't get it even more. I mean, he is prompting them here. You know, like a little kid, you say... Who's that? Is that Daddy?
Yeah.
Is that Daddy? You know, and
I'm gonna wait. I'm gonna wait on that one.
Here's
the answer for that one.
Here's a number of commentary passages in regards to these two points that we've just been discussing. Peter. Well, actually, let's start with here. The narratives invite us in, and the text is therefore interactive. We are expected to react, respond, and participate. So these questions, who do people say that I am, and who do you say that I am? Those are the two key questions in Mark's Gospel. Those are the two questions upon which all of Christianity
bases all
ends.
Yeah.
Peter, speaking for the other disciples, as he often does in Mark, replies, "You are the Messiah." This is the first time the title Messiah or Christ, the Anointed One, has been used since chapter 1, verse 1, the very beginning of this gospel, where Jesus' identity was announced to the audience by the heavenly voice. The disciples' progress from "Who is this?" to "You are the Messiah" is considerable. Peter has given the correct answer. The audience breathes a sigh of relief. At last, the disciples have seen the light, or have they?
Yeah.
Or have they?
Peter's use of the title displays some recognition of Jesus' true significance. The subsequent use of the title in Mark shows that although Jesus is the Christ, he is not the Christ of popular expectation. Further, in the crucifixion scene, the onlookers mockingly hail Jesus as this Christ, this King of Israel, and their demand that he come down from the cross illustrates that their definition of Christ does not involve one who suffers and dies in shame. Peter's affirmation was an exultant expression of faith. The subsequent narrative, which we will look at next time, however, indicates that it was also a reflection of a profound misunderstanding. Thus far in Mark's Gospel, Peter has witnessed Jesus demonstrating tremendous power in every way. Peter has the right term, Christos, but not the right meaning. But Jesus interrupts the applause with a command to silence. He rebuked them in order that they should tell no one about him. This surprising response recalls the exorcism stories in which Jesus rebukes and silences demons because they know his identity. The audience is dumbfounded. They know that Jesus is the Messiah because the omniscient narrator said so in 1:1. How can the disciples be rebuked in silence for being correct? Obviously, there is more to learn about who Jesus is before the news can be spread. Throughout this first half, Jesus commands the demons, the crowd, and his disciples to don't say anything because they still have no idea.
Because when Herod proclaimed him as that, as John the Baptist returned a second time, that was guaranteeing that Herod knew the level in which Christ's profound change could create for his lifestyle. Herod knew at that time, long before the rest of the public, before the disciples, that this guy's got to go. And so the demons knowing that, the people needed not to know that because he needed to be able to be as the person that he was on the cross, and he needed the time to be able to do that. And if he was proclaimed as that at that time, the target on his head would have been right there and he never would have had his chance to do anything.
So what we're seeing as the story develops in Mark is that Jesus' purpose in Mark's gospel is not to die on the cross, but it's the meaning of why Jesus ended up dying on the cross that's important.
His primary purpose in living is to
become weaker.
Well, his primary purpose is to change the culture.
Yes.
And simply walking up to the cross and dying isn't going to change the culture.
No, but that's pretty amazing.
But his purpose is to break the assumptions, all the assumptions about what God is.
Why does modern Christianity fail to take into remember 2 weeks ago when I kept asking, why didn't Christ talk about the rest of the world? Why don't we have these answers that Christ could, why didn't he just say that he's this prolific? That was pretty good because you led me right into it. But what really amazes me at this point right here is that if modern Christians really wanted us to understand the teachings of Christ the way that it should be, this history lesson would be the more paramount part of it. We would want to know more about the community of the world at that time should be more important to us, because having that history lesson recent to me as a grown person makes all of this more understandable, because it's real. That's a real timeline. That actually is going on at that time. That's real. Like, the Bible, if Christ was doing this at that time, it's not just this supernatural book anymore. It isn't. This is, in my mind, I'm reading about it. I'm watching documentaries about it. I'm seeing that this was a place in time, an actual event, a real world that was going on. But for a lot of people that go to church and listen to a sermon, are listening to a supernatural fairy tale that in time is just something that happened in the book of what Christ's story is. It's not a real history lesson.
All your information about the time and place comes from the Bible only, then you have to just take its word for it. What it's doing is
it's making the Bible in a scientific-driven, fact-based environment something of a storybook. Mm-hmm. It's not giving it its validity that it is an actual historical account of something happening during this time. These are people writing about somebody that actually existed, but most people, especially the people that don't believe in God type guys, what are they called?
Atheists or agnostics.
Agnostics are using fact-based information to discredit what the biblical writers are saying, but in all honesty, what it's doing is it's giving, in my mind, after recently learning these things so that it's fresh as I'm learning this, gives more validity to what was going on, because basically at this time, when you say a historical scholar, that's just some guy that read a whole lot of books about what people wrote about that nobody really knows exactly what happened, says that he knows what happened. Okay, I'm just really excited. That's awesome. It's not fair.
Okay, so have a number of...
Well, I have a question on Caesarea.
Yes.
There was a temple there for Caesar?
Yeah.
Who's Caesar?
Caesar is the emperor of Rome.
And they called the emperor...
A god.
God.
He was being developed into a god at this time.
Okay.
By the time
he was in the process of becoming a god.
Just a minute. All right. So Jesus was always called the Messiah or the Christ. They didn't really talk to him as such as a god, and neither did they talk to Caesar as a Messiah or a Christ. God is somebody who is in charge of everything. A Messiah is someone who saves people out of something.
Messiah is the anointed one. That's the literal definition.
So why the difference?
Caesar is anointed. David was anointed. Jesus is the anointed.
So why did we call Caesar God and not the Messiah?
The people in the culture were developing Caesar into a god. I don't think the Greeks and Romans were necessarily looking for a Messiah. They weren't looking for someone to save them out of.
The whole idea of a Messiah being important is limited to Jewish eschatological thought. See, in Greek and Roman thought, time is circular. In Jewish thought, time is linear.
Man, this is so much good stuff, though.
It'll come around. It's circular.
Here's some passages to reflect upon. Mark chapter 8, verses 23-26 fits in a larger narrative about the gradual lifting of the disciples' blindness that runs from chapter 8 through chapter 10. Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see, and ears but fail to hear? Here the blind man of Bethsaida is healed, which leads to Peter's confession. Finally, Mark 10 recounts the healing of Bartimaeus, who then follows Jesus on the way, meaning toward Jerusalem and the cross. At the end, however, it is the Roman centurion who acknowledges in 15 verse 39, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Peter and the disciples, by contrast, can only muster an accurate though incomplete confession in 8 verse 29. In Mark's Gospel, the disciples never come to the understanding that Jesus is the Messiah. At least in his true sense. Let's see. What's another one here?
Our disciples.
In Mark's Gospel, the disciples never understand. They say that he is the Christ.
But without any understanding of what the term means. So it related to that comment that was just made. Jesus is the Messiah that to these disciples look like a tree walking around. Even more disturbing is the fact that they never achieve clear sight or understanding, not in Mark's narrative. Commentators like to say that the resurrection was the moment that full sight came for the disciples, but not in Mark. The inability of the disciples in Mark to achieve sight is a source of tension. It is the same tension that Mark's non-ending creates. The rhetorical function of Mark's ending forces the reader to exclaim in horror, "No, it cannot end that way. The good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, cannot, must not end in fleeing fear and silence."
So the blind man sees partially. And that's maybe a metaphor for how the disciples were beginning to see, but only partly.
Right.
That actually makes sense.
Here, I have a statement here. It is easier to believe that a Messiah will come than it is to believe that one has already arrived.
You don't have to deal with it in your face.
Well, do the Jews still look forward to the Messiah
yes.
coming?
Today they still do, yes.
Right, here's another one. Is it not the case that we stand in the same place with his disciples? Like them, we may believe that Jesus is the Christ, but we may be even more confused than they about what that actually means. We are surrounded by 2,000 years of the Church's very diverse expectations, claims, and explanations about who Jesus is and what he does as God's anointed one. He has been used as a sponsor for conquests, crusades, inquisitions, empires, revolutions, wars, and all sorts of causes, noble and demonic. So what can we teach our children about who Jesus is and what it means to follow him and to live as his disciples? Let's see, and a couple of, let's see, two more here. Peter's correct confession is deceptive.
Uh-huh.
It points out an important reality. We can have what appears to be everything in order, words, actions, and so on, and still have it very wrong. Correct confessions can be deceptive. It can mask false discipleship, idolatry, and even a perspective that Jesus attributes to Satan. A perfectly correct mission statement does not reveal the true discipleship of either the pastoral staff or the congregation that appears to follow it to a T. And the last one here. The distinctive theology of the cross and resurrection implied by this announcement dominates the remainder of the gospel. The recognition that Jesus is the Messiah is thus the point of intersection toward which all the theological currents of the first half of the Gospel converge and from which the dynamic of the second half of the Gospel derives. In no other way could Mark more sharply indicate the historical and theological significance of the conversation in the neighborhood of Caesarea Philippi.
Okay.